Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a realm where reality intertwines with the inexplicable, where the boundaries of reason dissolve into the shadows of uncertainty. Welcome to the political twilight zone. I am your guide to this enigmatic labyrinth, where politics and power take on life of their own. In this dimension, the threads of truth weave a tapestry of intrigue, challenging our perception of the world we thought we knew. In this world, nothing is as it seems, and the truth lies buried beneath layers of deceit. Prepare to venture where reason meets the unexplained, and where the unexplained might just be. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to, United States of America. Yeah, I have to check because it doesn't look the same anymore. So we appreciate you guys joining us here on Kansas EKGLN. This is Rick Wagner, getting it right. Once again, not a hard job when there's so much out there that's wrong. So, you know, I mean, which makes it easier for me, which is frankly just what I'm looking for. But I was, you know, I had a thought, folks, when I was driving over here, that it just kind of occurred to me. See what you think of it. Why, I kept thinking to myself, why is it that we just don't seem to have the conservative muscle on our side? By that I mean the money, the institutions, the this to that. You know, we have to just sort of every so often get together, sort of band together once in a while temporarily and try and win an election. And then it just occurred to me, first of all, and we've talked about this before, I guess I should bring it up, we're not necessarily organizers where the first thing we do when we're not happy about something is go down, buy a piece of, well, let's see, what would it be? Styrofoam, construction paper, and a magic marker, and make a sign to start flaunting around at people. And of course, having a sign by yourself is no fun. So you've got to get more people involved, right? So now you got to call your friends, and they have to get their signs. And then what do? Now you have your sign. People have to see it. So you got to go somewhere and show them. So you go someplace, and geez, you know, I mean, unless something special's happening, maybe nobody will see you, and maybe the news won't show up. So you got to start doing crazy things. And maybe they get really crazy. And before you know it, you're on the news, and your signs are waving all over the place. And people can think about you what they will. But you've accomplished what you set out to do. And you've also done it, for the most part, without consequences. Because as long as you're someone on the left, you can say and do pretty much anything with your little sign, and that seems to be okay. But not so much on the right. But beyond that, just because conservatives aren't by nature collectives, right? We don't collectivize ourselves into little beehives all the time, right? We have a sense of identity, a sense of individual purpose, not a sense of collective purpose and collective identity. Collective identity is fine in the abstract sort of unifying principle, such as we're all Americans, or a certain sort of nationalism, or something like that, some agreement. You have to have those or you don't have a country. But beyond that, we want to be ourselves. And we want to be Americans, and we want to have this kind of thing because of that. Now, that's not so much on the left, is it? This is what's so hard to understand. Here's a little quote from John Locke, who was, as many of you know, a philosopher about politics that was someone who deeply affected the framers of our Constitution. I got a bunch of stuff here from him. Here's a quote. "The end of law is not to abolish or restrain, but to preserve and enlarge freedom. For in all the states of created beings capable of law, where there is no law, there is no freedom." You see that thinking? The purpose of the law, society, and the government that implements the law is to enlarge freedom, to make it more safe, to be free. We all know that, you know, just abject freedom, people do whatever they want with no consequences, is a problem. This is why you enter into government to begin with, to give up some of your rights. And those rights are supposed to be exercised by the whole to protect you. But they're supposed to be there to protect you so that you can go on about your life and essentially enlarge your personal freedom. Boy, that doesn't seem like what's the philosophy of the left now, does it? And the other part, this is what came to me. We don't have all this institutionalized power because we don't believe in it. We don't think the government should be really big. We don't think the FBI ought to be involved in everything. We don't think that the IRS should be monitoring everything you do every day. And we don't think the President of the United States should be all that important. Because we have levels of government. not just one, but we have a federalism system, excuse me there. And that's what we want. But here's the problem. In the meantime, all these folks on the left have been organizing one institution, either in government or out of it, after another, one collective. They've been raising money because they go to people who have money and they virtue signal them into it, or they threaten them into it, or people just feel guilty about getting their money, and they use that to create these organizations. I mean, look at all the organizations out there that are on the left that can field their armies out protesting in the streets or whatever the case may be. They just have to, like, throw a switch, and these people show up. Not so easy for people on the right, because we're not organized all the time. I don't mean that in a bad way. We're just not that kind of creature. We're not constantly waiting to get a whole bunch of people together and rush out and complain about something. We do things as individuals. Well, that's being kind of used against us. As the government's been built up, and this is where we let it go wrong, as the government's been built up, people are attracted to the government who enjoy a collective power. Because of that, they're easy to co-opt to people on the left who believe in collective power and collectivism, don't believe in individualism. So before you know it, the people on the far left, especially, have cultivated quite a weapon with your own money that they funded. Now, is our government completely bad? No. It still's got some redeeming features to it. Do we need a government? Yeah, we do. I mean, some people out there, even if you're libertarian, you have to think you need some kind of government. If you're an anarchist, you don't. I've never quite understood anarchy. I mean, for instance, if you're an anarchist and don't believe you should have any organizations, how do you have a meeting? Who's in charge? Everything about that is supposedly what you're against. Anyway, we have to have some form of government. And we just ignore government too much until it becomes so obtrusive that then we react to it. But by then, it's much more difficult because it has gained so much power. It has attracted so many people that like that sort of thing. Just because we don't doesn't mean it's not effective, at least effective against us, as a way to control the population, a way to get agendas across. We don't use a lot of these tools. We don't believe in constant fundraising for one kind of institute after another. Well, institutes are okay sometimes, but more some kind of, you know, organization, NGO, right? Non-governmental organization. They're just proliferating all over the place out there. And they are funded by donors who have lots of money and would like to see things happen in the United States a little differently, not necessarily to our benefit. It either makes them feel good, or they're just sort of being held hostage. Well, yeah, I'll give you some money and you leave me alone. And by the way, I'm wealthy enough to where whatever you come up with out there isn't going to affect me. At least they think that. By the way, that's not true. Eventually, they come for everybody. But we're sort of the Amish of the political spectrum. You know, I mean, we have good values. We want to have a straightforward, simple life. But we're kind of driving buggies around. And the other guys are driving sports cars. Because that's what they think works best. And it kind of does. The hardest thing for us to realize, I believe, is what we have to take a lot of their techniques without taking their attitude and apply them to not just fending them off temporarily, but to keep things going on in a way that precipitates action whenever someone is too aggressive. Because we tend to go out, if we're lucky, and get together. Maybe elect a President Trump, maybe President Reagan, right? But then we think we're done. We kind of put our hands together, and that's all right with that, and we go back to doing our business. In the meantime, the other side is all collected together, and all they meet and get together to, what, co-opt everything that you've just done and turn it against you, to some extent, to control you, because I think that's what works. Collectivists always think control is the best thing, not freedom. I'll be right back. Everybody, we're back. Rick Wagner here, getting it right, KZKGLN. So, after the first segment where I referred to most Republican organizations as the Amish of the political world, and in a good way, in the sense that they have good values for the most part and are trying to do the right thing, but they are using sort of the buggy to get around in the elections lately, you say, well, that's all easy to criticize, but what's the answer? Well, it is more subtle than that, or more subtle than you would think, I guess I should say. A lot of the folks, if you start reading this thing on Republican strategists, think that the Republicans just pretty much need to adopt the tactics of the left in terms of voting. And some of that is correct. We can't be voting everybody on election day like I would prefer, because we have to get more people out. We have to make sure that they're there. And one day, who knows what can happen, right? I mean, maybe somebody gets stuck at work. Maybe there's something else they had to do. Maybe they forgot. Some people are actually out working in places and not, you know, watching their phones the whole time. And so there's a lot of things that can happen to someone who on a voting day. So, okay, well, let's have mail-in voting for people who, one, can't be there, and two, we should have some voting maybe that starts early, then runs through, but it shouldn't be a month. We're talking about, and I know this is controversial for some people, we're talking about maybe 3 days, in my mind, is plenty of time. It's hard for me to understand in some ways how when you were riding a horse or being pulled in a buggy to the polling station, well, you pretty much had an election day. Now, when you can drive a car or an electric car or ride a electric bike, you know, electricity, it's the future, right, to your polling station quite easily, now we can't seem to find the time. And also, we have a lot more free time. It doesn't feel like it. I mean, we have a lot of noise in our lives, right? Background noise. Things we think we need to do, things that distract us, things that are really unimportant but we find ourselves doing instead of the important things. Yeah, and so that has a tendency to get in the way too. So we have to have people that are motivated to get out, and we have to have people that help them stay motivated. Remind them to vote. Talk to people. Talk to your friends. Make sure they've gotten votes out. All that stuff works. Ballot harvesting, I don't like it. I don't even like the term ballot harvesting. I have a, maybe when I was growing up, a little ranch out there, and when somebody says harvesting, I always think of, I'm going to see a combine coming down the field. That's the last thing I want to see coming at me. But yeah, I mean, they're utilizing that to make sure they get all the votes from people who otherwise might forget to vote or wouldn't vote unless somebody showed up and asked them for their ballot. To me, that seems intrusive, but it does seem to work. Now, does it also allow you to have a lot of votes in there that nobody knows what they are? Does it have a lot of stories about people who've discovered that their dead relatives are voting still? Which, you know, as I've said before, is that's pretty oppressive. The dead have every right to vote, right? Unfortunately, they can't. So when they do, someone else is voting for them. And that can't happen. I mean, yeah. I don't understand how it isn't a bigger story when you have places where there are more votes than there are registered voters. I mean, that's happened a couple of times, and in more than one place. I mean, how does that happen? I mean, how does that go on? And how do you have a lot of fraud that pops up where people say, my Aunt Tilda would be 112 years old, and I know she's not around, so how is she voting the last two elections? Everybody just gets kind of, Now, we're all aware, you know, that there's been voting problems since the time we first started voting, as I say all the time. But now it's almost like expected. I was listening to something the other day, and the commentators were saying that, well, Donald Trump's going to have to win probably by 3 to 5% in most of these states just to get past the ability to pile on questionable votes. Things that come in after the voting closes, you know, people find some boats floating in the lake out there, you know, that kind of stuff. And Yeah. But we're accepting that now. Isn't that strange? I mean, in the back of our minds, you always knew in some places, big city machine politics, so forth, you know, I mean, the Tammany Hall thing that lurks in our minds, right? Like I said, at least those people had to work to, you know, fabricate votes. They, you know, wear disguises and go to different voting precincts, pretend to be people, stuff like that. But we were always aware that there was a machinery in place in some of these places. Chicago was probably the best example after Tammany Hall collapsed, you know, a long time ago, where they got out. I mean, and the ward healers, the people in the wards that, of Chicago who were getting working on behalf of the politicians, would get out in their neighborhoods and make sure people voted. And they were pretty aggressive about it. I mean, not like beating people up, but they wouldn't let you forget. And they had what we now call, and I hate this term anymore, boots on the ground. How is it that we can have a simple term and it can just be beaten into us until we can't stand hearing it anymore? Transparency. What about the optics? I just hate that. And what I hate is occasionally I find myself using them now. Gets into the lexicon. I don't know when someone says, I don't think that looks good, or I don't think that looks correct, or whatever the case may be. Instead, you say, I don't think the optics on that are very good. Really? Should they be taken to an optometrist? Is that what we're talking about here? Because I don't think that word initially means something the way you're using it. It's all this idea that we want to have our jargon, right? And it all revolves around voting as well, too, about how they get people out and, you know, how they motivate the base, this kind of stuff. What we need to motivate is people who care. And there are a lot of people that care that aren't getting out and doing anything. And that's partly because, like we talked about the last time, in the last segment, rather, is that we're not, by nature, as conservatives, particularly prone to organizing. I mean, I've said that before. I said it last time. Just think about it. It's just not something that true conservatives cling to. If you see something you don't like, say in politics, you might write a letter. You might call your congressman's office, something like that. But you don't run out to some group that's formed that you're aware of and immediately start miking signs and trying to figure out what street corner you're going to go on to. Or, like now, you can't decide which campus you're going to camp out on. That's a different form of protest. That's even the lazier form of protest. What happened to the good old days in the 60s when people who protest at least sat outside? You know, they were ready to get rained on, get hot, whatever the case. No, not these guys. These are sort of pamper protesters, aren't they? They don't have a tent, probably have, like, you know, sandwiches in there, the whole kind of thing, maybe a cooler. You know, so their protesting is really lazy, which I think fits right into some of their ways of being. But anyway, we can't afford to be that way. We have to take our ability. They're motivated by rage and collectivism. We have to be motivated by common sense and patriotism. We get patriotism, which apparently has become kind of a nasty word now. Patriotism. Nationalism. Nationalism. Caring about your country. Oh, my gosh. That's oppressive. But we get that because we're proud of what the country has done. And we're proud of its history. No country has a history where everything that's ever happened in it has been all that good. I mean, there has been terrible things that countries have done throughout history. There has been slavery in the United States that was a stain on our history. There's been slavery in other countries. There's effectively slavery still going on in parts of the world now. There are a lot of things that have happened that don't make us perfect. But do we really seek perfection in our nations? Because we certainly don't seek perfection in ourselves. Well, some people imagine they're perfect. We don't do any of that, do we? So we have to fall back on American greatness, what we've done, and understand why America is the greatest civilization, at least on the planet, as far as we know. And that should make you proud. And if you're proud of your country and you'd like to see it keep going forward, and you think for the most part it does the right thing, that's patriotism. And if you want to protect it from outside influences that will destroy that, that's also a patriotic gesture. If you'd like to see your country put first when people are making the calculation about something, yeah, that's nationalism and patriotism. Yeah, there's plenty of times in a person's life where they might put themselves before, they put something else before their own self-interest. We do that when we are in the military or law enforcement, where things get testy. You do your job because you believe in it, and you're willing to trade sometimes your life for what you believe in. That's pretty impressive. Everybody, we're back again. Thanks a lot for sticking with us as we cruise past about on the hour there. By the way, I get occasional email, and folks, I don't give my email enough because a number of people have it, and I forget that obviously everybody doesn't. You can reach me at Rick Wagner, just my name, no dots or spaces or anything odd, at mail.com. And I get some nice stuff sometimes, and I get some funny stuff. But I do get occasionally this, you have a view about our bumper music. Like I've talked about this before, because I have a very eclectic, I like to use that word, eclectic taste in these things. And I was looking at our playlist for some of the things that I have on hand there, and I have everything from the theme from the Mighty Mouse cartoon to Frank Sinatra there to Pink Floyd, Steeler's Wheels, and the Talking Head. That's just what I see off my list right here. So either I have a very schizoid approach to things, or I'd like to think I have a broad range of musical appreciation. That's how I look. And also, I try and play bumpers sometimes, and you folks on the podcast don't get a chance to hear them. Kind of, remind me of what we're talking about or what's going on. And I think a couple of times I've had people on talking about education. I've played Pink Floyd's The Wall about those kids, leave those kids alone, because it's about education. I'm not sure they appreciated it, but they didn't say anything. They were very nice. But let's get back to talking about the core values we have to have to motivate us to do things. Because that's what we're fighting. Right? The other side has core values that are essentially antithetical. They exist in opposition. You have to understand that. That's why nothing is about moving forward. It's about stopping something, changing something, eliminating something, fighting something when you're on the left. You exist in opposition. Without that push, there's nothing propelling you forward. There's nothing pulling you forward. On the other side of the coin, more so for people who are interested in the country and think it's done pretty good up to now, you have one advantage, and that is that you can be pulled forward by your understanding and belief in the greatness of your country. Do that, you have to have some concept of where you came from. You have to have some real concept of how this country was founded, the things it's went through, the unattractive as long as attractive. And then, just like you judge people. Now, obviously, some people are a little more stringent about it, but for the most part, you look at people in as a whole. And everybody has a friend, sometimes a good friend, that does some things that they find really irritating. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but you all know what I mean. But they really like the person otherwise, and what they like about them far outweighs the annoying part of it. Right, like maybe they can never remember to pick up the check when a bunch of you are out for lunch or something. They're always suspiciously gone. Everybody has some friends like that. Nations are like that. You have to decide if what they've accomplished and where they're headed and what they say they're going to do and are going to do is, by and large, something that you like, that you think moves people and society forward. If they don't, if there's more one than the other, it's a little bit like comparative negligence. In Colorado, and this is, my practice, we do, accidents when people are injured in them. Apparently there's a lot of other people out there doing it now, too. Or at least advertising it. But you guys really been good to me. And I try and do the best job we can because of that. I feel incumbent upon me. But anyway, in comparative negligence, the idea is that you can be 20% at fault for your own injury, but the other person can be 80%. Now, is there really a way to put like a number on that? Not really. People just have to kind of agree on it. A jury will kind of come up with that number, what they think. You know, maybe the jurors don't think that you looked very well before you drove out into the street, but the person who struck you was going a lot faster than they should have, and that contributed to the accident a lot more than perhaps your inattention a little bit to pull out in front of somebody that was going very fast, and maybe the only way you'd known how fast they were going was to sit and look at them for a while. And so you're allowed to allot that. And when you get past 50%, if someone is responsible for their own problems at 51%, then that's it. They don't win. Well, we sort of approach life that way, shouldn't we? At least with our country. As Victor Davis Hanson has said, we can't let perfection be the enemy of good. You can always dig something crazy up about everybody. I mean, I was reading something about when they took the statue of Jefferson out of the New York Assembly, one of the people who was in favor of that, you know, that he was a pedophile slave owner. I don't think the first part's true. Well, the second part is kind of true. But when we put it on the balance, especially where they were headed and that they wanted to get rid of this practice and things, I think you have to weigh it on the good side. But not if you don't consider it. And not if you also don't really understand what good people do or what good a nation does. The United States has prevented more wars and more people from dying than we have ever inflicted on anybody. We've done that through our power and through deterrence. Deterrence comes about when people believe that you are solidified in your thinking enough that you will do something you don't want to do to protect an idea, an ideal, or another group of people that's that important to you. Now, sometimes a little bit of erraticism can be okay. People talk about that one of the things about Donald Trump was that world leaders weren't entirely sure what he was going to do. They weren't really sure what part of it was just sort of like blowhard, you know, kind of advertising, and what part of it was in there. So that made them step a little more carefully. They knew what Ronald Reagan was going to do because he showed them a few times. Very matter of fact about it. Didn't look like he was waffling around or, oh, I'm so, this is such a terrible this time. It's such a difficult decision. I don't, no. This is right. This is wrong. We're on the side of right. We think it's important enough. We're going to take some action. Going to put ourselves on the line. That kind of thing is deterrence. We don't have any deterrence in the world anymore. Not much, anyway. They don't know what we're going to do. We certainly are not friends to our friends. We seem to be friends to our enemies. And who could rely on us? Obviously, if you live in Israel right now, you're starting to wonder how much you can rely on the United States. They're essentially trying to conduct the foreign policy of Israel by withholding armaments, which they don't even blink at into Ukraine. I'm not sure we even know where they're going. You may remember that we've tried to put some kind of eyeballs on this aid to Ukraine, you know, inspector generals, things like that, and it doesn't go. Why is that? I mean, honestly, don't know. Because of that, we just send things over there. It's like tossing it out the door and then closing it. In the meantime, we want to control Israel's foreign policy. Well, really, who's more important to our interests and to what's going on in the world? It's got to be Israel. I'm not saying the Ukraine is have some import, but Israel is a toehold for the West in that whole region. If it's not there, I don't know what it would look like. And the fact that it's been so successful has really rubbed raw a lot of the people around it. It isn't just because they don't like the ethnicity or religion of people. It isn't. It's because, and this just sounds crazy, but I think in the United States you see this too, they're jealous of them. A lot of these countries have managed to pull themselves all the way up to the 17th century, the way they live. Some of them have, you know, the really advanced ones have gotten up to the late 18th century, 19th century, maybe early 20th. But for the most part, they can't seem to get it done because their political structure is antiquated, their education system is spotty, and they are split in many instances by tribalism within them, within what's going on. So they don't like somebody that's successful in the same area that they live. Because then it starts coming, well, why can't, you know, we be as successful as Israel? Well, then you have to get into what has become sort of the new lingo here. It's because they're an oppressor. Just, that's kind of the new way to explain how one nation, one society or something is more advanced or wealthier, whatever the case may be. They must be oppressing somebody. It's just sort of a more narrow variation on they're stealing. That was, you know, the thing about Trump originally was, he was dishonest in how he got all his money and this and that. And they're still trying to go after that to some weird extent. But it only really sells in, you know, Washington, D.C. and New York, apparently. I guess we'll see what goes on in Atlanta. Anyway, you will get into this duality of oppressed and oppressor. And one of the things that's really dangerous about that duality is that in the United States, the divisions have largely been of class. Because we talk about it all the time. Middle class, upper class, lower class, whatever the case somebody talks about. And class is something that can be changed in a person by success. Because it generally revolves around a lifestyle and your ability to be successful. And we all know people who are really successful, and you can't figure out why. But that's the nature of the world. Fate weaves the strangest net sometimes. But that's something that you could lean on. And you could say, no matter how oppressed you have been at one point, in this country, we work very hard at making the differences that always exist in society of some sort to revolve around things you can fix, revolve around things you can change. Your circumstances, the job you have, where you live, your education, whatever it takes, then you can move through our society. Our society has an elevator in it. You know, many things run that elevator, and you can move through it. But if you start taking tribalism and then disguise that as oppressed and oppressor, then you freeze everybody. People are frozen in their positions when it comes to that. And so you get someone who lives in Appalachia who probably, you know, has a fifth grade education, works hard every day, maybe in a coal mine, and barely scrapes by. They're an oppressor, if they, depending on their ethnicity and whatever. And someone who has every advantage and has money and education and everything are sort of by nature the oppressed. Think how dangerous that is. Because it creates an insolvable situation. Let's say that were true. What's the solution to it? Because what you're saying is everything's a power relationship. And if it's a power relationship, the only way to change that is somebody else has to seize power. So is the converse of that you have to become the oppressor if you're the oppressed? Because I haven't heard any kind of idea about how you have a society that doesn't have some sort of division in it, either monetary or, you know, you figure it out. Maybe how tall you are or short you are, whatever the case may be. There's something that's going to do it. And some of these countries that criticize us have terrible records in terms of how they divide their own people up and how they treat people on their own borders, other countries. Mexico's a good example of that. We're constantly being lectured by, you know, that idiot, president down there. I can't think of his name exactly, so I'm not going to say it. And they're proud of the fact that they're shipping all sorts of people into our country. The remittances that we send across the border is a huge part of their economy. Plus, in their mind, they're creating a constituency in the United States so that policies that benefit Mexico will be enacted, because there's a constituency in the United States that votes in the United States, and they're in favor of something like that. I don't think that's necessarily the way it's turning out. I think this idea from the left that somehow that everybody that comes over the border is going to become a refugee in society and have to be supported, and the people who want to support them immediately will, of course, be the Democrats, and they're going to buy their vote forever. I don't think that's necessarily true. Because, as usual, it is the sort of tyranny of low expectations, isn't it? Think about what they're really saying. What they're saying is that if you come across the border and you're trying to get out of one of the, say, the far southern provinces of Mexico, or you're trying to get out of Guatemala, or, good Lord, Venezuela, that when you come here, you will constantly be unable to make it without them. They have to be the savior. They are the great hope. So that attitude really belittles the people that come here. They can't do it without them, and they probably never will, and because they need them, they'll vote for them. I'm not sure that's the way it's turning out. I think probably a good 40% of the Hispanics, as we like to throw everybody into, are supporting Trump. Probably more. Hispanic males, I think, are much more in favor of that. They don't like crime. They don't like any of that. They don't like an economy that costs them $7 a gallon in some places in California to put in their work truck. Because they work. They drive. They go to their jobs. Sometimes the job's far away. They don't have an electric car to buzz around downtown San Francisco. And so that's changing. The same thing for the black vote. People starting to see what the wages of this support that you're giving, what it comes back as. And it's pretty paltry. So when we get out, people who have been here for a while, know their history and this and that, we need to bring those things up. And then we need to use that to motivate ourselves and to motivate others. We live in a country that has a couple of things that others don't. We talk about freedom all the time. And I say that liberty is just as important as freedom, and they're not the same. So, by the way, I decided to take a look at some of the classical writings that influenced our founders about sort of a definition between the two, because I am talking about it all the time. And freedom is kind of a broad stroke. It's the power to act, speak, think as you want, without any restraint. It's more individualistic. It can be understood as the absence of subjection to foreign domination or a autocratic government. It encompasses both absence of interference and the ability to choose your own actions. That sounds pretty good. But some of that, if left unfettered, begins to create a society where other people's freedom is going to be impacted by people's actions. And they won't have the ability to act because other people's exercise of their freedom sort of overwhelms them. So that's why liberty is important. Liberty is a state of being free in a society without oppressive restrictions opposed by some authority figure, usually a government, on your way of life, behavior, political views, whatever. It's a framework which freedom is exercised within. The concept of liberty often involves social and political systems, right, that ensure individual rights and protect individuals from external constraints that might arise in a purely free-for-all kind of environment. You guys see that. America has not perfected that, but they've come pretty close. We've come pretty close. No one in history, for any length of time, has had much individual freedom and liberty as United States citizens. Just do a look a little history. Even ones that we think of as we're pretty free, not quite. We're the freest people that have the most liberty that probably have ever had any kind of organized society that lasted at all. So that's what needs to be given to people to motivate them to action. The attack on nationalism and patriotism is really an attack on your enthusiasm and your will to preserve what you think is good in society. It's trying to force you back. When we make patriotism and nationalism, particularly patriotism, a factor that is looked as a problem, what point is there for anybody to defend their country? What point is there to have anything to support their country? What's the reason, if you believe that, that you would get in the military and put your life on the line or some other profession? I mean, you just wouldn't. And we're seeing that now. So I guess all this long talk I've given today that is a plea to be fully armed, the full armor, as it were, of our nation, and use that to propel you forward and to just let things bounce off you from the other side that are trying to prevent you from exercising not just your, maybe your right to vote or something by, you know, trying to dissuade you, things like that, but rather your right to be proud. That's what they're really after. They don't like you being proud of your country. That means you might get out and do things to support it, which is not what they want. They want everybody to be sort of fragmented, and they just want to step into the breach. One wonders what they think that society is going to look like. I never quite can find out what these people who have a bad view of America thinks what the alternative ought to be. Is it something like one of the European countries? Is it a historical example? Is there something you could draw that I could see? Could you do a Venn diagram of it? No, never really gets talked about. But we know what does work and what promotes good in the world.
Hi, folks. Thanks for listening. Listen, if you'd like to listen to more and you want to maybe perhaps have someone else listen to our podcast, you can do so either by going right to our webpage, politicalviking.com, or therickwagnershow.com. Both of them take you there. You can get links right directly to our podcast. Or you can hear our podcast on Podbeam, on iTunes, and Spotify, and a couple others. So you can find us. We appreciate it if you do. And if you've heard the show, you want somebody else to hear it, that's a good way to send it to them. Thanks for listening.